Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And with us now in the studio is Frankie Roberts, Executive Director of LINC, the acronym for Leading Into New Communities. Welcome, Frankie.
Well, thank you for inviting us, Rachel.
We're happy to have you here. We're talking about gang violence today, or youth gun violence in our region, and we're going to talk about the use of those terms in a second. We're talking about what we're learning after all the public discussions, what's working and what isn't. If you know someone involved in a gang, if you live in an area that's been plagued by gun violence, or if you're involved in one of the many local organizations that's working hard to address the problem, we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. or tweet us using CoastlineHQR. Frankie Roberts, tell us about LINC, Leading Into New Communities. What is the mission of the organization?
Well, the mission of the organization is twofold. One is we provide residential reentry for people who have been formerly incarcerated. We have a residential facility at 222 Division Drive where our capacity is we are able to house 20 men and 20 women who find themselves coming out of prison and homeless. We also provide what we call academic support, employment training, and also a curriculum on teaching the hidden rules to middle-class culture for African-American males 16 to 21. So that's a twofold mission of our organization.
You said you teach a course on the rules.
Hidden rules.
The hidden rules to navigating middle-class culture.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, certainly, like anything or any system, there are rules and then there are hidden rules. But we don't normally think of the hidden rules of middle class culture as a system within itself, especially when the young men we serve, which sometimes I even take for granted, that the rules that it required to be successful wasn't wrapped into the fabric of their upbringing. So what we have done through a process is ensure that these young men understand what those hidden rules look like, what they are, and also where to look around the corner and see them so that they can be successful in that system.
For those listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, give me an example of a hidden rule, something that an at-risk kid might not grow up understanding, but he needs to be taught.
Okay, I'll use a pretty basic one. I'm in a classroom, got a young man that grew up in the inner city, and a person walks in the classroom and asks this young man, how long ago did your teacher leave? And the young man out the inner city would probably say, she been gone.
Mm-hmm.
And which we would consider in that environment improper English. But what a teacher would typically want to do is ask that young lad to restate that. And then if you restate it in proper English, we would say the teacher left 15 minutes ago.
So you're really talking about some cultural differences here.
Cultural differences, because if the teacher left 15, 20 minutes ago, he been gone is just as accurate as she left 15 minutes ago. But those are just rules that I'm not going to be affirmed or accepted in that environment if I can't speak the King's English very eloquently. And what the average person wouldn't think that was a rule. One of our young men would say, Mr. Roberts, why would that matter? That doesn't make me a bad person.
Sure. But it's the perception about
Correct.
That child. So we're talking about a cultural issue. Are we also calling this a racial issue?
Oh, absolutely.
So is there training for teachers that could be a part of the bridging of this cultural gap or racial gap that we know we have in this area?
Well, yeah, but let's look at it from a different perspective, because I know teachers get bogged down and sometimes disregarded when you use the word cultural competence, diversity, and that. What we call it from where we sit is professional development. We think that teachers, if they can understand professional development, or rules that govern the so-called ghetto where a lot of students would come from, because it's a system just like the school system, judicial system, any other system, corporate American systems. The so-called ghetto, and I say so-called, is a system also. And in order to be effective with individuals that come from that reality, a teacher needs the professional development to understand that system also.
We have an email from Christine. She says, years ago, I worked with at-risk 12 and 13-year-olds in the inner city of Kansas City. The young boys in particular were drawn into gangs because they needed a sense of belonging. Some of them had a chaotic home situation without positive role models, no one to help them do schoolwork or take them to after-school recreational opportunities. The gangs offered them something to do and someplace to be. We need to give our children positive places to belong. Is this what you're seeing right here in Wilmington, Frankie?
Yes, I would say to a degree, yeah, that is what we're seeing. You know, you have to give young men, a youth, certainly something to do. But I think we have to give them something to do, which is learn by doing. And doing positive things, being able to have access and opportunities, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Students and children will be successful every time all day long if that's the expectation of the community. And when we look at and I try to move away from the at-risk word, but I try to use the word youth who haven't been able to understand their promise and their purpose and their passion. And we see that primarily with the African Americans we serve.
And talking about just terms that we're using, we've been talking about gang violence and we've been talking about gun violence in the young community. But you have a beef with the term gang violence.
Yeah, because it's a code word for black kids doing gangbangers, thugs. It's a code word. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I take issue with that. I think that, you know, again, more positive terms, because, you know, if you see five or six young men on the corner, the perception that the community have is there's those old gangbangers, especially if they have locks in their hair or sagging pants, a white T-shirt.
So are you saying they're not gang members?
You wouldn't know if unless you engaged or into a conversation or if I'm a person who had been reformed from a street capitalism lifestyle. How would you know if you never engaged that person and pretty much treated all black guys the same? And let me just make this one point. OK, I was raised in Wilmington in the inner city, went to a private school K through eighth that taught mastery. So when I went into the public school, Rolling Rice and Hargett, I was extremely smart. It's just the reality.
When you say the school taught mastery, what do you mean by that?
It taught you to master everything you did, math, reading, science. So when I landed—
It taught you a way of approaching
absolutely,
a subject.
Consistently. Okay. And if you had any weakness, they was going to ensure that weakness became a strength. And so— But because I was out of the inner city and used to go through that line, lunch line with the free lunch ticket, the teachers and administrators treated me like what their experience has been as a gangbanger, where that wasn't my reality. And so I got lost and had to develop a subculture to survive and become mediocre so that the teachers would be happy that this young kid, this poor out of the inner city, is a dummy like we perceived that he was.
So you're saying when you were in school, you were safer. You felt safer. You felt rewarded for mediocrity.
Absolutely.
Instead of excellence.
No, that's
excellence was threatening is what you're saying.
Excellence was threatening to teachers and administrators from a poor kid. Now, my friends who were doctors and lawyers' children, they weren't treated that way. It was as though they were expected to be smarter.
How does that? That's one of the ways that race plays into the perpetuation of kids going into that kind of a lifestyle. What are some of the other ways that racism is encountered by African Americans in this community and feeding into that cycle? I mean, what are the things that you think white people just don't understand?
That the perception of a black versus a white, because when we talk about gangbangers, and as you looked at today's paper, 70% of the gang members, they say, are black. So just by that that mention, that means that blacks between 16 and 25 typically can't be businessmen, entrepreneurs, successful working young men. Because, again, when we're talking about gang members, we aren't talking about white men between 16 and 25. So I think that's how it plays itself out, so that I don't get the same opportunity and the same access, because when I walk up the street, I'm already put in a category as an undesirable. And then law enforcement then focuses on isolation, containment, and control versus liberation, freedom, and opportunity for those young men.
And there's a term that you've used before. On the flip side of that, you've used the term white privilege.
Oh, good God Almighty.
What does that mean?
Well, there are certain privileges in America that is merited to a person when they're white. And that is, you know, the systems are designed around the success of white men, then in white females, then black females, and then black men are typically at the bottom. That's typically the pecking order. And I don't say that to be crass or disrespectful. I say that as being the reality that we see. And so if I walk into a bank, if I see all white tellers, typically, if I see white bankers that are typically male, obviously, if a like person or the kinship to being white, when I walk in that institution, it's going to be more embracing and receiving of. And I just think we have to be a little bit more intention to tear down the artificial barriers like color and gender that separates us, so that we can kind of cross those lines to improve and enhance everyone's success.
But when you say tear down those barriers, you're not talking about homogenization, because there has been a lot of talk about how schools in New Hanover County are rather segregated. And yet, back in the days of segregation, Williston, for example, was considered to be a very good school. That was an African-American school.
Yes, that was
right. And you say there is something to that, because these kids weren't being taught to be white.
Correct. Correct. And let me qualify that. Williston, being one of the greatest schools under the sun, was ranked top five in the nation of all schools, black or white. But it's never expressed or embraced that way. So here's a black school from a little town like Wilmington that's ranked in the nation. That's not affirmed. So I think it's something that's said for black pride during that time, which was our practice. So when you desegregated, integrated, you know, we can take issue with what really happened. Why would you close a black school that was ranked top five in the nation and make those kids enter a white system that was not designed for their success, versus send some white kids to Williston and some white kids to Hanover? And we have to look at it. It was done, in my humble opinion, intentionally, and look at the psychological impact that had on black students to go from a majority environment into a minority environment where the teachers and administrators really didn't like them anyway.
I want to get to this email from D. Harold Green. He's the author of The Rites of Passage for Males. And he says, if you do not help these young boys and men to get good paying jobs, then they'll continue to use gangs to socialize and earn income. Dropout rates and unemployment rates ages 16 to 24 in Wilmington are appalling. We are a national online job skills training program headquartered here in Wilmington. Okay. That that trains trainers nationwide to teach at-risk males life skills, self-esteem, and self-sufficiency. We have over 750 master trainers nationwide on, okay, he goes on to talk about the online job skills training program. Tired of the talk, let's do something. How would you respond to him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a good approach.
You also have mentioned there's these subtle differences in language. We've talked about white privilege, and I think that's something that a lot of white people, perhaps a term, are not familiar with and probably also not aware. As Dr. Timothy Tyson, the author of Blood Don't Sign My Name from Duke University, has said, fish don't necessarily know that they're wet.
Correct.
But what is your final thought? If you could just share one illuminating thought with the community about addressing this problem, what would that be?
That would be engage in more conversations and be receiving of each other's perspective and be willing to step and sit in each other's shoes so that you can truly build a relationship, because at the end of the day, relationships is how we cure all of these challenges and differences.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Frankie Roberts of Link, Deborah Dix Maxwell with the New Hanover County NAACP, and New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon and his program coordinator, Christy Williams. Thanks to all of our listeners and those who called, emailed, and tweeted during the conversation. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Join us next week. We're talking about public education in North Carolina. Where are we headed after state leaders make their budget decisions during this short session? That's next week on Wednesday, July 16th at 2 p.m. here on WHQR 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Ken Campbell. Associate producers are Bob Workman and Lindsay McGrath. Our technical coordinators are George Scheibner and Lan Nichols. Our music editor is Bob Workman. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and our guests, and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio or our licensee, Friends of Public Radio, Incorporated. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.